Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with regional and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
Over 30 years ago, today's guest wrote and directed episodes of the TV series Cheers, but a decade before that, Rick Barron was a student at California State University, Chico. Now Rick Barron has written the story of how he found himself in Butte County Jail and Vacaville State Prison. The title of his autobiography is Jailhouse Rick, A Young Man's Tale from State College to State Prison to State-of-the-Art Television Comedy. Rick Barron, welcome.
Wow, that sounds pretty good when you say it. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, the title of your book probably tells the whole book right there in the title.
That's sweet.
And on the cover of your book is this young man with a frown on his face.
Yeah.
And talking to you, you seem cheerful. But what was this picture? After reading your book, I thought, oh, he must have learned to scowl like that when he was in prison.
No. Well, I did. But not scowl. You had to have kind of a neutral face. At least I did, because, you know, I'm a little guy, and I was petrified and didn't know what to say. You just don't know what is right and what is wrong, and if you're going to offend somebody, which I did, and say something to possibly help somebody that you want to help, because you naturally want to help somebody. Everybody's in these terrible situations. And so you kind of offer your help. I offered this guy, he asked me if I could help him write a letter to his girlfriend. And I understood that because my girlfriend was in jail also. And it happened that his girlfriend was in jail. So he came to me and said, can you help me with this letter? Well, he shows up in the yard with 300 pages of scrawled little tiny letters. And for me to decipher what he was trying to say, it was like the Unabomber's manifesto. So I was just trying to help him. And a guy that was kind of looking out for me, he knew what was going on. He said, you know, get over here. I know I can't swear, but he said, get over here with the swear word in the middle of that. And said, you can't help that guy. And I go, why? You know, and he goes, his girlfriend was in the same prison in another section, and he had become somebody else's girlfriend. And there was huge fights and battles and to the death, literally, over these relationships. So he was trying to get his girl back through this letter. And if I became involved, I would be part of somebody's side, and they could have retaliated against me. So, you know, you just have no idea what I at least had no idea what I was doing. But that frown was real. I was very, very unhappy.
The anecdote that you just told reminded me of how often you use puns, Rick, because one of the you used that opportunity. You said, I had clearly put myself in a bind with this man's binder.
Yeah, oh, yeah, right.
I got a kick out of the puns that you would sneak into your book. Another time you were talking about swimming, and you said maybe I could synchronize it. But, oh, yeah. Okay, I see that, yeah. Rick. You're at it again.
Yeah, I was, trying to be clever. I've been around a lot of great writers. In fact, I was lucky enough. I had this book signing, and which I'd like to do up in Chico. I think you and I talked about that. I'd love to do a book signing up there where it all began, where it all happened. But I had one a couple weeks ago here, and I looked up, and there was five of the greatest writers I've ever worked with. One of the guys created Frasier. I worked with him on Cheers and Wings. Another guy worked on Cheers and Wings and other shows. And a couple guys from Cheers. And I'm signing their books and writing little anecdotes. And I go, guys, this is embarrassing. I mean, you know, you're the writers. And, you know, but they were very gracious. So they're good writers. And I just happened to fall into this story.
My guest is Rick Barron, a.k.a. Jailhouse Rick, and he's written an autobiography that tells how he went from Chico State College to State Prison, Vacaville, to state-of-the-art television comedy, which you were just mentioning then. And you don't dwell on that in your book. You mainly tell your horror story. And just the very end of the book, you tell us about Cheers and what a wonderful opportunity you had there. So I'm wondering, and you do tell us in the book, who was it that said, hey, Rick, you should write a book? Only she wouldn't have said Rick. She probably would have said Dad.
Dad. Well, you know, I always kind of wanted to write a book about this, but I was too lazy and a little busy and just didn't know where to start. And what to, I kind of had an idea. I kind of had started a few decades before and just abandoned it. And then I was golfing one day and my wife called me and she says, honey, I hadn't told my daughters. My daughters were in their mid 20s at this point. And not that they would have been shocked. I mean, I'm not a Marine or anything. I mean, I'm pretty loose to be around and my daughter had found this letter that I had written to my dad's best friend, who was like a family friend. My dad went to college at Cal with him in the Jewish fraternity. That's another thing. There's not a lot of Jews in jail, so I didn't have a lot of people on Saturday mornings to go to shul with. That's temple. And not that I wanted to, but I would have, you know, done anything to get out of the daily ordinary drudgery. So she found this letter because irresponsibly, my dad, who was totally responsible and completely supportive, brought his best friend to Vacaville Prison. And his best friend was this judge.
And he thought he was doing you a favor, but
he was doing it as a support. Well, this goes back a long story. It'll take me a little bit of background is the first night I was in jail. I mean, they take you from, they took me and my girl at 9 o'clock in the morning. They take you and you go to jail. You know, you walk out of the courtroom and you go to jail. And there's no, can I go get my clothes out of the laundry? Can I, you know, pick
go
up?
Go tell my dog goodbye. No.
And my dog, I could not, you know, you're in there. And I walked into this bleak cell block with a dozen people, and I had to pick this empty cot, and I did, and it was next to this guy, and he was in the corner, and he was all prepared. He had a whole stack of things, and he was nice.
Rick, forgive me for interrupting, but remember, the question was, who encouraged you to write this book? And you said you wanted to write it.
I thought we were talking about this was got to the letter, I was kind of getting to that story. I'm sorry.
Because you have two daughters.
I do.
And you had not told them. They didn't know about this background of yours.
They
until
didn't know.
One daughter came across, your daughter Lily came across this letter.
Right.
So
right. She came across the letter. So I had written this judge who had come to visit me. And I was trying to tell you this story before. I'd actually smoked some pot before I went in to visit the judge, which I had to do because this guy who I'd met the first day was smuggling pot into the jail. And I ran into him after months in down in Vacaville, and he said, do you want to smoke some? And I didn't know whether to answer yes or no. You don't know what to say. So I did it. And I actually got high. I don't smoke pot very much, so I got high. Anyway, they called my name over the speaker. I walked through all these chambers into these secured areas past the warden's office, and there is my dad and the judge. And I was like, oh, my God. You know, and I said, am I leaving? And they said, no, you're not leaving, but look who's here to visit you. And I go, I can't be seen with this guy. I mean, he sent other guys out there to prison for 30, 40, 50 years. You know, I'd be massacred. So that's the background of the letters. But the so my daughter found the letter that I'd written the judge thanking him for visiting me and saying, I'm going to be a good boy and straighten up and make you guys all proud. So I came home and my daughter said, I go, okay, what, you know, what is, she goes, what's with the letter? And I go, well, honey, you know, a long time ago, I, you know, got into trouble. And I was waiting to tell them this in case one of them was in super trouble, like, you know, break up with a boyfriend or something horrible. So I could say, look, I survived this and you will too. You'll get over bad things happening to you. That's part of life. So she looked at me and she goes, I don't care. Like, you don't care. I've been waiting 30 years to tell you this story and you know, the right moment, and you don't care. So then she got a phone call from her boyfriend. She goes into the other room and she's like, I'm looking at my wife like, what? And she comes back out. She goes, okay, tell me. And I go, no, you say you don't care. She goes, no, I want to know. I go, well, I was in jail. And she goes, that's it? And I go, well, yeah, I mean, you know, that's pretty big. And so she calls her sister. Oh, then Carol, my wife, goes, he was in there for like 5 months. So she started laughing. She's just cracking up. I go, great, my kids, you know, very loyal and supportive. So she calls her sister, and across the country, they were just laughing at their father being locked up. So that's, you know, if anything bad happens to me, I know who not to call. That would be, you know, Lily and Emma.
My guest is Rick Barron, and his book is Jailhouse Rick. And I would like to go back to how your story begins in Chico.
Okay.
And you have September the 21st, 1977.
Right.
And I'd like you, if you would, to read the first couple of paragraphs in that chapter.
Okay. I will start. September 21st, which is like the Earth, Wind, and Fire. Do you remember? The 21st of September. Lucky I didn't go into singing. So, says, fresh start, a spanking new semester at Chico State University. Mind you, I had barely passed the last one. I was visiting my girlfriend, Amber, at the Sports Page bar where she was working. We'd been together for about 6 months. She ran the small place by herself. She would sneak glances at her school book between serving beers. Me, I was sneaking glances at her. It was worth the look. Oh boy, I'm going to not answer that, but it's going to beep, okay? Sorry. It was a rather slow evening. I guess others were also doing that studying thing. Amber was really stressing with all of her coursework, so I suggested she go home to study. After some hesitation, she agreed to let me fill in for her. I hopped over the bar. Well, walked around behind it. I'd always wanted to bartend, but I never could seem to get hired. Here was my chance. No interview, no experience required. It was just a beer and a wine joint. What could possibly go wrong?
Rick, I have two questions about that. One,
okay.
You mentioned in your story, your girlfriend's name is Amber.
Yeah.
And her real name, you said, was Mira.
No. Let's not say her real name.
Okay.
Yeah.
The and I wondered, too, you say the Sports Page Bar. And
yeah.
I thought, that's probably not the real name either.
Is that it? Is the real name.
Oh, the real name. There was a play. Okay. That was before me. Okay, the Sports Page Bar. So this is how your story begins. It's the start of the semester. Everything's going smoothly. And you get arrested.
I did. Yeah.
And so did Amber. And you felt terrible. That she got arrested also. But what then, when you do get put in jail, those of us who don't have any experience with that, it's just a horror story, what it's like. I felt I was with you all along the way. I mean, oh, my gosh. So I would like you to read from your book, too, what you have to tell us, those of us who are not familiar with the inside of a jail.
Yeah.
Tell us what it was like. I'm going to ask you to skip over to where you're telling us about, well, for one thing, your courtroom, you had to take off the clothes you wore to court and put them in a bag.
Yeah.
And then supposedly these clothes would be waiting for you when you got released. And then what were the clothes like that they gave you to wear?
Well, they puts you in a dressing room, and it's not like Neiman Marcus or anything, and you can't check out yourself and or check yourself out. And they hand you a pair of jeans that must have been worn 300 times. I don't think any of them had been washed. And they're not really fitting you to make you look good or anything. And I got a pair of jeans. They might have been 40-inch waist, and I was probably 30-inch waist at that time. And they were, like, from the original gold mining era. So they'd probably be worth a lot of money now. But they, they dress you, and then they put you in some shirt of their, property of Butte County. And you get a bedroll for a mattress, and that's about it. And then they walk you down this hallway or into this section, and you walk in past all these angry-looking guys. And I was saying, I'm glad I'm on this side of the bars from those guys. And well, then
your ribs were hurting. You said,
yeah, oh, yeah.
At the time, you said my ribs were killing me because— somebody with a steel-toed boot kicked you in the rib cage. And you say even 40 years later, it hurt.
It
was sore when you breathe.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They took us away. They took both of us away. And
both of us meaning you and Amber, your girlfriend.
Yes. Yeah. And the next an hour or 45 minutes later, I don't know. We were called into this, I was called into this room, and it was a visitor's room. And I was, great. I mean, and I saw my parents and my brother, and I was so ashamed and happy and scared and unhappy. And I was talking to them, and then Amber's sister got on the phone and said, first, she says, your brother's a fox, which is typical of her to, have that kind of reaction. And, she was jokingly, but being sweet. And I was mainly concerned how Amber was doing. I felt really guilty. I felt like I had caused this for her. And so I asked how she's doing. And she said, she's fine. She goes, do you want to talk to her? And I go, there's nothing more I'd rather do. So I went. And she goes, well, here. So I went to the far right of my area. You have thick glass. It's about 3 inches thick. It's bulletproof glass. And you have a phone receiver attached to a wire cord. And they have the same thing on the other side. And so she goes, go all the way over to here. And then she went all the way over to Amber's side. Their areas, you could cross from side to side. Our area was blocked by a cement wall.
And this is what got you that kick in the ribs, right?
Yeah.
That phone call. Just
yeah,
an innocent. I mean, this was something innocent you did. You get kicked in the ribs, and that pained you for ever after.
Well, I knew it was probably not right. I knew that what we were doing, I'm not innocent. I knew that it was probably not good.
He took he shouldn't have been doing that. But you mentioned in your book, too, that you kind of felt white privilege. You felt privileged to be there. And so I guess you thought you can get away with this phone call and somebody set you straight by kicking you in the ribs.
Well, they had some batons, too. And then one well-placed kick right at the end. Really, really.
Well, you describe in your book, you say, we walked past two cells that housed 12 men. So would you read that section of your book?
Okay. You cut me off whenever you start falling asleep, okay?
Okay.
We walked past two cells that housed 12 men, each sitting on cots. I'd never been so close to such a collection of miserable and angry-looking guys in my life. I was thankful to be protected from them by these thick bars and the officer. Then it dawned on me, I was being brought to live amongst and become one of these men. We stopped at a heavy iron gate. We had reached the murkiest area. The door slid open. 11 souls were sitting in front of me on the floor. Their outstretched legs blocked my entrance. 22 eyes stared vacantly up at me like coal miners who had been stuck in a cave for days. There was no indication that anyone was going to move. I shifted my bedroll to assure a firm grip. I did not want it or anything of mine to accidentally fall onto someone and cause a problem. I especially did not want my very loose pants to drop to my ankles. I held on to both tightly and moved forward with trepidation. With each step, a pair of legs would slowly and begrudgingly contract out of my way. I really had no plan as to where I was headed. I suppose I was looking for an empty cot to place my thin mattress on. Once I found a rack that was empty, I unfolded my gear and sat down on my new home. I rubbed my eyes with my palms and furiously massaged my scalp, a behavior I'd found myself repeating several hundred times that day. A full minute of my sentence had now elapsed. I had a lot of time ahead of me. I looked around, my eyes beginning to focus on my bleak surroundings. No windows, completely barred in, no escape. I know the sun must have been shining somewhere. Still couldn't have been much past noon. I sat on my bunk, pulled my legs up, and curled myself into a tight ball. I was trying to look as much like a hardened criminal as I possibly could. I wondered if that was the way. I had no template for how to be, no guidelines, no instruction manual. Did I act tough and encourage someone to challenge me, or should I act like a harmless idiot, which I truly was? I did not know how to read jail social norms. I was on the spectrum here. I had prison autism. On pure instinct, I managed to quickly calculate that it was better to be quiet and observe. I needed to learn how to behave properly in order to survive. I was exhausted, but extremely wired and too petrified to close my eyes. Unfortunate, as it was pure agony to even blink due to the searing pain in my head. My ribs didn't feel great either. You want me to stop or keep going?
Well, we can pause there because I think people can get an idea of what your situation is like. And as I'm reading this myself, you know, here you are stuck with no windows and barred in. And I'm thinking, if I went in that circumstances, totally sane person, I don't see how I could stay sane. I think it would,
I know. When they arrested us, we were taken to get arraigned or booked or whatever. And we were in there for 45 minutes. And I thought, I couldn't do 45 more seconds of this. Mm-hmm. And you get in there and you look around and you just can't believe it. You're really, really locked in a cage, and the windows are 20 feet high. And, you know, there's a little small band of windows above 20 feet up in the air, a cement wall. And you just are shocked at where I found myself. I was, you go from the gorgeous Chico downtown Funland. You know, Chico in the 70s was the number one party school in America.
In fact, I think you said that had something to do with your choosing to come, because you grew up in Oakland.
Choosing
to come to Chico, number one party school in the whole United States.
Yes, it was. It was. It was great. It was a great, great, fun place. One of the most fun places I ever was at. It was like heaven, night and day. And good fun people and a good school I was having the time of my life. I had a girl. I really, really thought I loved her, and friends, and my dog. And I was in college, and there was lots of activities going on. I kind of did this stupid thing. I mean, certainly I did it, and I was not innocent.
My guest is Rick Barron, and his autobiography is Jailhouse Rick, A Young Man's Tale from State College to State Prison to State-of-the-Art Television Comedy. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Rick Barron, who has written a book about the time he spent in jail. The title of the book is Jailhouse Rick. And here you're walking among these angry men, and you do meet a guy named Bob.
Yeah.
And you did something that you didn't even think about. You came back from lunch, and here's some lunch I didn't quite eat. And you offered it to Bob. What did you offer him, and how did he react?
Well, Bob was this guy that I told you about earlier that had smuggled pot into Vacaville in his anal region. And I was watching him do that for a few hours. And we were talking, and he was offering me cigarettes. And then he offered me a book, and he told me kind of how to behave. And then he also volunteered to send a note over to Amber, which they called a kite. It's like an illegal communication. So he was kind of my friend. So I went to lunch, and I came back, and I think it was an apple I gave him, or a
Yeah, you did. That's what you say in your book.
Yeah.
An apple and some milk.
Yeah, just simple. Because he wasn't there, and I don't know what maybe he was sleeping or something, and so I came back, and again I don't know if he would have stabbed me or something for doing that, but he started crying. He was just he was so moved, and it's such a difference in the life that I led growing up and he led. I mean, he really had little opportunities and little support at home, and lived a rough life. And here we were sleeping head to head or foot to head, whatever we ended up doing. And, but he was really touched and moved by that. And he was, I think you and I were talking about this. I mean, I think if there's just more education and more support for people that are kind of leading a life that may be going off track, there'd be probably less need for all these prisons that we keep building and putting money in. I think the figure's like 22 state prisons have been built in California since the last university has been built.
One thing you say in your book, if they would only put 5% of the cost of building prisons and monitoring housing while providing food, health care, legal assistance, and recreation, if they would put only 5% of that into public education, we might not need as many prisons.
That's kind of the same note. Now, I don't know those figures. You know, I just kind of spit out 5% as a number that of the billions that they are spending. Mm-hmm. And I don't know the numbers, and I'm not an expert in any of this. But I just would think that education and services could really go a long way, and instead of incarceration, that's kind of what I would think and could really help. And this, and now, you know, this was almost 50 years ago, so now it's even needed more. You know, the services that when I was around, there weren't this homeless type of situations and drugs that degree. There wasn't meth or anything. We're talking, pot and
And you weren't that much of a smoker, but there in the beginning, you were smoking cigarettes. You said about every 10 to 15 minutes, you were smoking cigarettes.
I was putting a cigarette on after. At the end of a cigarette, I'm prone to migraines. And so I had a migraine and I wasn't a smoker. And at that time, I guess I would maybe a little bit, but I probably smoked 3 or 4 packs that first 24 hours. And there's no air and there's no medicine. You can't go into the medicine cabinet and get an aspirin. You know, you can't walk into the hallway. There is no hallway. You're stuck in a cage. And, you can't do anything for a headache. You can't get a glass of water. You can't close your eyes. I mean, it's loud and it's the bathroom was particularly a toilet bowl about 3 feet from my face. Mm-hmm. That's where the 12 guys went to the bathroom. So, you know, you've kind of got.
So all your senses were assaulted.
They were assaulted.
Yeah. So much of your time is wasted.
Yeah.
Anytime you go to a meal, they have to count the silverware.
Right.
Because that you could use, anybody could use that as a weapon. And
right.
So dozens of times a day, you'd have to have the silverware counted. And I thought it was interesting, too, a weapon. I would have never thought of a bar of soap in a sock.
Right. I know. I don't know. So this one guy, he was kind of a leader of some sorts. This was in a different configuration. This was after the Bob group of people, and because people are always coming and going, and I'd come back up to Butte County, and I was waiting to go get finally judged and hopefully released. And there was this younger group of angry guys, and they weren't going anywhere. This is the type of guys that could really benefit from some direction. Mm-hmm. And so they were pitting one guy against another guy, and the other guy was a Native American, and he was a nice guy, and he, you know, his only crime to these other guys was that he was a Native American. So they were kind of bullying him, and the leader kind of instigated the his second guy to attack the Native American guy, and he took a bar of soap and they put it in a sock and they swing it around. And he went to go swing it at the guy's head. And luckily, the guy was too dumb to complete his task. And the bar of soap hit a iron crossbeam above the guy's head and just shattered into dust. I mean, imagine if it had hit the guy's head. It would have, he could have killed him, right? Just right there. And, the ingenuity that these people have
And you mentioned he was Native American, and at one point, you'd grown up in Oakland. It didn't matter somebody's skin color. You talked to whoever you wanted to talk to.
Yeah.
And you got called down for speaking to and I won't use that N-word.
Yeah.
And you observed that, you previously mentioned that you didn't see any Jewish groups, for example.
No.
And use very few Asians, but you
right.
What did you observe about ethnic groups?
Oh, well, they as it was pointed out, I was walking out with this guy and he was black, and I just fell into in step with him, and so I just turned and said, "Hey, you know, how you doing? You know, are you okay? I mean, what's up? You know, and this is awful." He's like, "Yeah, you know," and we're walking, and he's not saying much, and I'm not saying much. And this other guy who kind of was like, you know, he ended up trying to look out for me. He goes, "Man, you can't talk to that dude." And I go, "Why?" And then he said that word, and that was why, you know, the N word. And I said, and the guy was right there. And I'm like, "Oh, you can't, what's going on here? I mean, you know, there's nothing wrong." And so he goes, "Look around," and you know, the blacks hang out with the blacks, and the whites with the whites, the Mexicans with the Mexicans, and that's the way it is. And you know, everybody's kind of guarding everybody else. There, if somebody's doing something, his ethnic group is watching everybody else while they're doing what they're doing. If somebody's lifting weights or something, and they're vulnerable in that position, he's got two or three guys watching out to the other people so he doesn't get stabbed or kicked or hurt or robbed or anything. And you kind of have to find a group of people to protect yourself. And it's, you know, I found this really lame, not very smart white group, and they ended up not protecting me at all. But, you know, luckily I was able to kind of weave my way out of any trouble, which I kind of got into a couple times, just situations that could have gone worse if I didn't de-escalate.
Let me give the title of your book again, Rick. The author's Rick Barron. The title of his book, Jailhouse Rick, A Young Man's Tale from State College to State Prison to State-of-the-Art Television Comedy. After a break, Rick Barron and I will be back to continue our conversation about his book, Jailhouse Rick. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Rick Barron, author of Jailhouse Rick. And based on your experiences, those of us fortunate not to experience this, I found so interesting what you have to say, your recommendations, if I want to call them that. For example, in your chapter 31, and this is in April now, so we've fast-forwarding ahead, and you have to say, you talk about punishment, and you say, I'm not going to get into the politics or economics of why we imprison so many, mostly poor people and people of color in our society. I'm certainly no expert, and it's true, but you have this experience. So would you pick up there and read that rest of that paragraph, Rick?
Okay, I'm looking for it. What is it?
This is page 143.
Gotcha. I'm not going to get into politics or economics of why we imprison so many, mostly poor people and people of color, in our society. I'm certainly no expert. I do think there needs to be a place where people who are dangerous to the general population should be sequestered. But obviously, someone who has had figured out how to make a lot of money through this process, some of us, my hand is raised, need not to be punished in this fashion. From my now expert point of view, I believe that some crimes should be punished by allowing the perpetrators to do beneficial labor, hand raised again, for the area that they committed their crimes, manual labor, safely away from the general population. As I said before, I feel that too, Rick,
that there's some people, depending on the crime they commit, like what you did, if you were walking down the street, I wouldn't be afraid for myself or my family to have you walking down the street. So that is a different punishment, in my view, than somebody who commits a crime that I would be scared to death to have my family walk down the same street as a person like that. So you're making that contrast, too. So, yeah, if you'd continue.
Well, you know, oh, reading? Okay.
Yeah, you can.
Okay. Let's see.
And
I might have.
Well, down the middle of the next page, you say most time spent was wasted time.
That is true. Most time spent was wasted time. I got that it was punishment, but I wish there had been something constructive that someone better and smarter than I could figure out to do with all this wasted time. Plus, my God, the resources that were being squandered. I read in a 2018 paper, 40 years later, that since 1978, there have been 22 prisons built in California and exactly one university. I didn't ever graduate from any of these universities. Again, I'm not capable of solving this issue. I'm just here to observe, recollect, and recount my little tale.
Yeah. You're reading for what you said in that paragraph, that since 1978, when you left prison, there have been 22 prisons built in California and exactly one university. And and you talk about how boring it was.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Just
and well, it's excruciatingly boring, and then, you know, there's, but you're filled with terror. You know, I mean, you're constantly on alert, but from the moment you wake up, you're waiting for the cells to open, and then you're going in a line down to get something to eat. Then you're going in a line to eat. Then you're going into a room after you eat while they count the silverware, and you're sitting there. And at any moment, it's boring, but at any moment, it can erupt into a full-on fight or upheaval. And, anything can happen at any moment. But then you go outside and you're just sitting around and you're trying to keep yourself occupied. And I tried to write. I read a lot. I read hundreds of books because I felt if I was reading, I could be reading in Cabo San Lucas or in Vacaville State Prison, and I'd be reading the same words. So that kind of eased my mind. And I did a couple jobs, that...
Well, getting back to just kind of sitting around, I found it interesting that you, when you were listening to these conversations about the crimes that these guys had committed, they used the word victim not the way we would expect them to. So when they mentioned a victim, what did they mean by that?
Well, they felt that they were always pointing to somebody else that caused them to be in there. It was always somebody else's fault. Like somebody snitched on them or somebody screwed up that, when they were perpetrating a crime, or the cop had it out for them or something. It was never their fault. And I heard this over and over again, because that's all anybody really talks about is their crime, what they did and how screwed over they got and how much time they've got to do. And then they would talk about how they would do it over again and do it better, so they wouldn't get caught. Yeah. And I would listen and I wouldn't just fight myself not to say anything. But then finally, I just said at one little, circle of people that I was sitting on the outside of, I just said, stupidly probably, hey, you guys, what if, you think about not doing this? Like, let's, because they were saying to get rid of the witnesses, and that meant like killing people. Mm-hmm. That's how they would get away with it the next time. And so I said, how about like trying not to do this, and maybe you won't be in this situation. You won't find this. And I went on for a few minutes of, kind of like lecturing. And I thought I was being gentle and
tactful,
logical.
As
tactful as I could. Mm-hmm. And, there was silence for a second. And I thought, all right, now I'm going to die. And they just started laughing. They really thought I was joking.
You make the point in your book, you said this place wasn't about rehabilitation.
No.
It was an academy in becoming a better criminal. Do you have that page 152? If you flip to page 152, right in the middle, that middle paragraph, you say what you think about the prison system, our system.
Let's see, 152. You know this book better than I do. Okay.
I read every
this
word.
This is why I believe this prison system is greatly... Or should I start with most
everyone
says
this? Yeah. No, okay. This is why I believe...
Mm-hmm. This is why I believe this prison system is greatly flawed. It is not a deterrent. I reiterate, I do not know how to solve this situation. But I also, having firsthand experience, believe that letting many, if not most of these guys out at all, is letting gravely dangerous people loose on innocent and unsuspecting future victims. Let's just say that 99%, perhaps more, of the conversations in prison are about crime. Crimes committed, crimes gotten away with, crimes to be committed more successfully in the future. The latter was the most common. Mind you, this conversation rarely, in fact, never that I can recall, ventured into the area of not revisiting the scenes of the crime. It mostly, if not always, included lengthy oral disseminations of strategies toward perfecting the crime that had landed them in prison. When this led to the unanimous verdict of eliminating all the loose ends, human beings here, I could barely believe my ears. I still held on to the guilt and remorse from not RSVPing to Nancy Taylor's sweet birthday invitation back in the sixth grade.
My guest is Rick Barron, and he's reading from his book, Jailhouse Rick, A Young Man's Tale from State College to State Prison to State-of-the-Art Television Comedy. And you give you're not one to brag, Rick.
I know.
You give very little ink to your success. I mean, you were unlucky, yes, all this, you were unlucky. But my goodness, how lucky you were in your career with television. So how did you manage to turn that around, your
bad
luck?
Well, you're right. The word is luck. There's a saying I always, when people want to know how to get into television, I tell them it takes talent, timing, and luck. Mm-hmm. And I had a little talent and some timing and a lot of luck. And I got out, and I always wanted to write. I was always able to write in throughout school. I could always write and well and funny so I wanted to write for television, and I had no connections or anything, and I got a little job on Entertainment Tonight, which was like I was kind of like just filling out these books for the show, and what was on air that night. Excuse me. So I used that to go on to sneak onto the Paramount lot, because I was on the show, so I could sneak onto the lot. And I snuck onto the lot, and I took a script that I'd written for Cheers, because I'd written Cheers. I'd watched Cheers religiously for every episode for the first two seasons, and that was my show. And I took the script to the secretary that was there. The show was on hiatus. There was no production going on. And I gave it to her, and she said she'd read it. And she called me a few hours later, and I thought, oh my God, I'm going to be a writer on Cheers. And she said, this is okay, but they had the best writers in all of television history, which I soon met. And I said, look, I don't care then. I'll just do anything. I'll collect, water. I'll sweep the floors. I'll do anything to get here. So I eventually got hired. And then within a day, I got shifted over, and I met with the director and one of the creators of the show, and I became his personal assistant. And he and I really connected, and I was able to be on the stage all day long and just watch him. And he's like, he's a comedic genius and the greatest television director in history. And I got to sit here and watch him direct Cheers day in and day out, and then watch the writers write Cheers and the actors act Cheers. And I got to see the greatest television show being made year after year.
Well, before we wrap up, I want to mention people who back in the day were grateful that you invited Kelsey Grammer. You were responsible. Here's Coming to Chico. But I also, I'm not sure we made clear why you were arrested. A quarter gram of cocaine led you on this adventure for most of your book. And then you had this great success, and you were involved in over 600 episodes of television. My goodness, Rick. So anything else you want to add now that we've run out of time?
I would like to, you would mention, I would love to get, come up there and, sign copies and meet people and do whatever I can do to kind of, I think, kids, it's kind of like a cautionary tale for kids going to college. So maybe some, high school kids or something could.
Well, there's one last thing I wanted to add.
Okay.
We mentioned your dad only in passing. Yeah. And he is such a hero. Oh, my goodness. We just, the reader just came to love your dad, Nana, your grandmother also. But I just wanted to give a special word of appreciation for your dad, because he even, after he tried to reverse your sentence, and he even was hospitalized for 3 days. He had a panic attack trying to help you. So I want to leave on that note of your wonderful dad, and thank you for your information about the prison system.
Thank you, you're welcome. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Again, the name of his book, Jailhouse Rick, A Young Man's Tale from State College to State Prison to State-of-the-Art Television Comedy. And the author is Rick Barron. And next, we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
Compassion. Let me tell you of all the ways I have suffered, and let's drink this bitter tea together, warming our bellies and throats after pulling each other out of the cold mud that chilled our hands and faces with the numbness of winter. Let me mix my tears with yours and make bread that will sustain us another day, so we can start again, dusting off pants and drying cheeks as our little ones go bravely into the world. You and I were meant to walk this tightrope together, between two worlds, but always together. My face is your face, your shame, my shame, but also joy. That all is forgiven, letting grace stream in from streaked window panes, warming our smiling faces. Molly Paul.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.